Welcome, everybody. A pleasure to see so many people, and it's really a pleasure to welcome back Dr. Sokolow, Moshe Sokolow. We had the pleasure of learning with him pretty much every Wednesday night this past year. We did the Haftarot of the week, and so now we're moving on to the putting together of Tanakh, and it's really a pleasure to have him, as I'm sure you'll all know, and I'm sure many people back from their Haftarah class. Just before we get started, tonight's year is being sponsored by Ruth and Larry Coburn to commemorate the yahrzeit of Ruth's father, Eugene Friedman, Hananya Yontif Lippa ben Shabsai, Ruth's brother, Stephen Friedman, Shabsai ben Hananya Yontif Lippa, and Larry's grandfather, Jacob Frieser, Yaakov Aharon ben Chaim Yosef, and in appreciation of the many informative and moving shiurim which Torah Motion has organized over the past little while, and I want to thank you for that. Thank you for your sponsorship. We should have long life and happy occasions to come together. Even though I'm sure many people here know Dr. Sokolow, and we're here last year too, but just we'll give a brief introduction as we do begin our first of the series. Dr. Sokolow is the Associate Dean and holds the Fania Gottesfeld Heller Chair of Jewish Education at Israeli Graduate School of Jewish Education at Yeshiva University. Teaches doctoral level courses on history and philosophy of Jewish education, on curriculum development, pedagogy, Limud HaKodesh in general, and Tanakh in particular. Actually, the first time we met Dr. Sokolow was when he spoke on our series last summer when we did the 24 books of Tanakh and, 24 different speakers. Excuse me, pardon me. We gave one of those talks. For this class, I'll say he's the author of numerous books and articles, but Tanakh, I guess for our purposes, Tanakh, an owner's manual, authorship, canonization, Masoretic texts, exegesis, modern scholarships, and pedagogy that he authored together with Chaim Angel. And it's really a pleasure to welcome back. And we look forward to many weeks of learning on, a fascinating and important topic that I'm sure many of us do not have so much knowledge of. So, Bakasha, Dr. Sokolow, we look forward to your class.
Thank you so very much, Rabbi Kelman. And thank you specifically, particularly to the Coburns. Always good to see you and to share words of Torah with you. Notice I was very careful. I didn't say words of Torah. I said words of Torah. So indeed, what we're going to do over the coming months is to have a look at how 24 Jewish books became the Bible. We'll start with the subject of authorship, according to first the Jewish tradition, and then eventually looking at it also from a more academic perspective, who were or might have been the authors, editors, or redactors of each of these 24 books, who was responsible for what's called their canonization, that is, who identified these 24 particular books as being holy, and designated them collectively as what we call Holy Scripture, Kitvei Kodesh. We'll look then subsequently, after the subject of authorship and canonization, we'll look at the question of the text, physically, the text itself. How did we go, as it were, from two stone tablets to a printed book? What are the likeliest materials on which the original biblical books were written? And how did they go from those original shapes to the shape, to the form in which we recognize them today? We'll then look at questions of, okay, we have a Bible, what do we do with it? So we'll look at some of the major trends in the interpretation of the Bible. Interpretation primarily in two ways. First of all, interpretation through translation, because essentially every translation is of necessity an interpretation. And secondly, by way of commentaries. Who are the people who actually labored, some of them throughout their whole lives, to try to elucidate the biblical text on our behalf? And then eventually at the end, we'll look at some of the more modern and contemporary questions that arise apropos of the Bible, going from biblical criticism to biblical archaeology and things like that. So hopefully I can share my screen with you. Yes, I can. I will take you through this evening through the first of a series of PowerPoints. As you can see, this one is entitled Authorship. That's the highlighted one. We will, as we go along, highlight other of the principal features, but we'll start this evening, as I said, with the subject of authorship, redaction, and then move on to canonization, the Masoretic text, and then to interpretation. Please feel free to ask any questions. If the question is not a particularly burning one, then please, as in past, put it into the chat, and I will leave time over at the end of the hour to review all of those questions and comments that appear in the chat. If, however, you have a question, or if the case is that you feel the urge to make a statement that can't wait until the end of the hour, then if you are invited to unmute yourself and to share it with us. I hope that the system is up to it. The classes that I've given in the past did not feature live discussions, so I don't know exactly whether if you interrupt me, I don't mean interrupt in the pejorative sense, but if you interrupt in order to ask a question or to raise a point, whether that brings your screen into focus so I can actually see you, or whether I will just simply have to hear what you have to say.
No, it should bring their screen into focus. And, you know, you can, you know, we'll play up with you. It is good. Sure, you can ask me if they have any questions, but generally, we'll keep that to
a... We'll see. As I said, I'm sure that there will be questions. I'm sure there will be things that need to be clarified. And as I said, if something is really, you know, if you feel an urgency, then please, we'll see how it goes. Okay, so let me start the PowerPoint and move us along. Okay, so... here is the Tanakh. You can see that I've highlighted the Tav in the word Torah, the Nun in the word Nevi'im, the Kaf or Chaf in the word Ketuvim. And that, of course, put it all together, and what you got, you've got Tanakh. It's curious, I guess, that somebody a long time ago decided that it should be Tanakh rather than Tanakh. I don't know why, but that's the way it's come to be. So you can see that there are 24 constituent books in the Tanakh, 5 in the Torah, okay, 8 in the Nevi'im, 5 and 8 is 13, and another 11 in the Ketuvim, for a total of 24. And indeed, those are the number of canonical books. That is to say, if we ask how many Kitvei Kodesh, how many holy scriptures are there, then there are 24. Do the same thing in English. Again, you see the 5 books of the Torah. You see the 8 books of prophets of Nevi'im. And here I have applied to them some of their conventional designations. So the 8 books of prophets of Nevi'im are conventionally divided into 2 categories. One is known as early prophets, Nevi'im Rishonim, and the other as later prophets, Nevi'im Acharonim. It's somewhat of a misnomer because the book of Kings, the book of Malachim, actually goes from all the way through the end of the era of the prophets, so that Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel, and the so-called minor prophets all fit into the time frame of the book of Kings. So it's not, strictly speaking, a chronological distinction, but it is more chronological than anything else. You also notice that the 24 canonical books of the Hebrew Bible do not separate the 2 books of Samuel, the 2 books of Kings, or later on the 2 books of Chronicles. right? What in most printed Bibles appear to be two separate books are, from the perspective of the Jewish tradition, merely two parts of one book. In case we don't mention it when we get to the Middle Ages chronologically, so I will tell you that the division of these books, Samuel, Kings, Chronicles, and for that matter, the book of Ezra, is from the Jewish traditional perspective a single book. And at the same time that Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles were split in half, so for some reason was the book of Ezra. And because Ezra had a companion, Nehemiah, who worked alongside him, somebody decided to attribute the second half of the book of Ezra to him, so that instead of it being called Ezra 1 and Ezra 2, we refer to them as Ezra and Nehemiah. And these divisions are not Jewish in origin, and as I said, they occur only in the Middle Ages. Okay, when we come to the Ketuvim, which literally means writings, could have used the word scripture, I guess, because literally the word scripture also means writings. There are also several internal divisions. The books of Psalms, Proverbs, and Job are known as Ketuvim Gidolim, major writings. And that's probably more a testimony to their size than it is necessarily to their importance. Psalms is, of course, the largest book in the Bible, having 150 chapters. Proverbs has however many chapters it has, the book of Job as well, and each and every one of them is as long as or considerably longer than most of the other writings, and therefore the other writings are known as Ketuvim Ketanim, or minor writings, and they include, first of all, the five Megillot. An interesting thing to note about the five Megillot, and we will see this when we go through the Talmud's description, is that they are organized in the sequence in which they are read liturgically in the synagogue, starting with the month of Nisan and the holiday of Pesach, of Passover. We read Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs. The Scroll of Ruth is read on Shavuot. Lamentations, we call it Eicha, is read during the summer on Tisha B'Av. Ecclesiastes, we call it Kohelet, is read on Sukkot, and then the book of Esther is read on Purim. We will see that the Talmud has a very strikingly different arrangement. And the last three books of the Tanakh are effectively the last three books to have been written. The book of Daniel, the book of Ezra, the book of Chronicles, which were written either during the period of the Babylonian exile or during the very earliest part of the Second Temple period, that part of the Second Temple era that is generally called the Persian era, the era under which the land of Israel was part of the Persian Empire. And that would be until approximately the year 330, when Persia was defeated by Greece and the land of Israel came to be part of the Greek Macedonian Empire. Just to give you some sense of where these books might fit into an historical timeline, I just simply took this off the internet. I'm not responsible for it. And therefore, I'm not responsible for putting the books of Zechariah, Haggai, and Malachi at the very end, as though they were later than Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther, which, as a matter of fact, they aren't. I don't know who's responsible for this. But it gives you some sense of where the biblical books fit into the chronology of the First Temple. So if you wish, we can obviously overlook the period that's called universal history all the way at the beginning, and even the period of the patriarchs, because even though the lives of the patriarchs are covered in the early chapters of the book of Genesis, the first book of the Torah itself obviously wasn't written at that point in time. The Torah was written either at the end of the 40 years in the wilderness or during the 40 years in the wilderness. That's a difference of opinion in the Talmud. So if you look at the little balloons that are at the very top of the timeline, you can see that the second one is called Entrance into Canaan. And if you see what it's pointing to the year 1408 BCE. Okay. So if we were to pick, a date for the writing of the Torah, that would be a reasonable date to pick, because the Torah certainly, even if it was written on the installment plan throughout all of the 40 years in the wilderness, there's no question but that it was completed by Moses shortly before his death, and that would be on the eve of their entry into the land of Canaan. I'm not particularly impressed by the choice of 1408 as the determining date. There is a question, an outstanding and long-standing question about biblical chronology, but that's something that would take us certainly at this moment far afield. But just to get a sense, as I said, you see that if you now look below the timeline, okay, you can see that 1406 is Deuteronomy. As I said, that's certainly the point at which Moses completed the Torah. And then the book of Joshua is written during the period in which the land of Israel was conquered. And then we continue to the books of Judges and Ruth and Samuel, which were written during and reflect the events that transpired during the period of the Judges, the Shofetim. And then we have, again, to me, it's a reasonably arbitrary date for the for what they mark here for the beginning of Israel's monarchy. Then subsequently the division of the kingdom during after the death of Solomon, and then the fall of the northern kingdom and their exile to Asia Minor, and then the fall of the southern kingdom, which is the kingdom of Judah, and their exile to Babylonia. Then we have something called the restoration of the land. That is the proclamation of Cyrus that allowed the Jews to return and to rebuild the temple. And then we have something called a post-exilic period. That's the period of Ezra and Nehemiah, a period in which they engage primarily in the rebuilding and reconstruction of the walls of the city of Jerusalem. So there basically we have the Tanakh, from the book of Genesis at its very beginning to the book of Chronicles at its very end. As I said, there are some oddities in this timeline, but it certainly gives us a reasonably correct picture associating the different books of the Bible with the historical eras in which they were written and whose events they reflect. Okay. Now we can take a step back and look at the organization of the 24 constituent books of the Hebrew Bible according to the Jewish tradition. And that takes us to the Talmud. It takes us to the Masechet, to the tractate of Bava Batra, beginning on Daf Yod Dalet Amud Bet, the folio 14b, and continuing on through the next folio, Tetvav Amud Aleph 15a. And it starts as a baraita. A baraita is a Tanaitic text. And it says, Sidran Shel Nivi'im, the order of the books of the prophets. And it lists them, Yehoshua v'Shofetim Shemuel u'Milachim. That, if I were to take us back two slides, is exactly the order of what I designated as early prophets, the Nevi'im Rishonim. Joshua first, Judges second, Samuel third, and Kings fourth. So far, so good. But now there's a bit of a difference. Our order, if you recall, or if you've got a Tanakh handy, right after the book of Malachim comes the book of Yeshayahu, Isaiah. And that's followed by Yirmiyahu, Jeremiah. That's followed by Yechezkel, Ezekiel. And those three are followed by a collation of 12 smaller prophetic books, which are known collectively as either Shneim Asar or Trei Asar, which is Aramaic for 12. And for some reason in the English Bible, somebody decided to call them minor prophets. I think that the term minor here doesn't mean minor in significance. It means minor in size. Isaiah has 66 chapters. Jeremiah has 52. Ezekiel has 42. And most of the books of the Treasar, of these 12 books, have some cases, Ovadia has only one chapter. Jonah has four, right? Zechariah, which is the longest of them all, has 14. So relative to the size of Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, and Yechezkel, the books of the Treasar are minor. As I say again, minor not in terms of their significance, but minor in terms of their size. And if we look at the Talmud, we see, however, that the Talmud has them in a slightly different order. Rather than Yeshayahu coming first and followed by Yirmiyahu and Yechezkel, the Talmud has Yirmiyahu first, followed by Yechezkel, and Yeshayahu third. We'll see as we move along, and we'll see the full Talmudic text, we'll find the Talmud's explanation for this. Okay? The Talmud is certainly aware of the fact that this isn't the sequence that we would expect. Because if we follow the sequence from Joshua to Judges to Samuel to Kings, the sequence clearly is a chronological one. Joshua followed immediately after Moses. The Judges led the Jewish people after the death of Joshua. Samuel took over after the era of the Judges was over, and Samuel oversaw the coronation of the first Jewish kings, Saul and David. So clearly, the organization of the early prophets is chronological. And if we were to arrange the later prophets in chronological order, that would be the order in which they appear in our Tanakh. Yeshayahu lived before Yirmiyahu. Both of them lived before Yechezkel, who lived during the Babylonian exile, right? And then again, as I said, since the minor, so to speak, minor prophets cover a wider chronological range, because after all, there are 12 of them, they couldn't be placed in their exact chronological order. Therefore, it makes sense to have the entire anthology of Treasar coming at the end. And as I said, when we look at the more extensive Talmudic text, we'll see the logic behind this non-chronological sequence. Then the Talmud moves along, and it asks the same question of the Ketuvim, of the scriptures. Here you see the word hagiographa. Hagiographa is just simply a fancy Greek word. You surely recognize the substantive graphic as having to do with writing. Hagio is Greek for holy. Hagiographa means holy writings. In Hebrew, Kitvei Kodesh. So the Talmud wants to establish Sidran Shel Ketuvim, the order or the sequence of the Ketuvim. And here again, you see, it is unlike the sequence that we saw in the previous slide. The previous slide first had the books of Tehillim, Mishlei, and Iyov grouped together because they are the Ketuvim Gedolim, the larger works of Ketuvim. Then we saw that our sequence grouped all of the five Megillot together in the order in which they are read in the synagogue. And they were followed at the very end by Daniel, Ezra, and Chronicles, the three latest books of the Bible. Here, the sequence we will see again in when we look more at the more extensive passage in the Talmud, we can see that the sequence is chronological in the order of the people who are assumed to have been the authors of these books. So the sequence has the book of Ruth, which according to the Talmud, as we will see, was written by the prophet Samuel, okay, first. And then the book of Tehillim, Psalms, because it was written by David, who was a generation after Samuel. And then, let's leave the book of Job aside for a moment because it's complicated. The books of Mishlei, Proverbs, Kohelet, Ecclesiastes, and Shir HaShirim, the song, were all traditionally written by Solomon. Solomon, of course, was the son of David, so we're moving in a chronological order from Samuel to David to Solomon. Okay. Keynote. Well, that's a rather, I don't remember the word, the book keynote being part of our Tanakh. Anybody have a Tanakh in which one of the 24 constituent books is called keynote? I thought keynote is a book that we take out on Tisha B'Av and we sit on the floor and we read it. Yes, indeed. But keynote literally means lamentations. And that is the Talmud's name for the book of Lamentations, the book that we have come to call Eicha. The word Eicha is not really the title of the book. It doesn't describe the book. It's just simply a handy way to identify it because the word Eicha is the first word in the book. So the book that the Talmud calls Keynote is the book of Lamentations that we call Eicha. And that, of course, was written by the prophet Jeremiah. So we've gone now from the beginning of the First Temple period all the way to the end of the First Temple period. And then we get the books of Daniel and Esther and Ezra and Chronicles, which were written either during the Babylonian exile or during the, as I said, during the Persian era of the Second Temple period. Notice that there is something that is glaring in its absence. What is absent from the Talmud's discussion is a passage that would begin Sidran Shel Torah. Nowhere does the Talmud tell us what the sequence of the five books of the Torah should be. And that I can only imagine is because it was something that everybody knew. Nobody needed to be instructed in it. There were never any questions about it. There were never two different ways in which to look at it, as we've clearly seen that there are two different ways to look at the organization of the books of Nevi'im. There are certainly two different ways to look at the organization of the books of Ketuvim. And again, as I said, we will read that somewhat more extensively beginning with the next slide. But there clearly were never any questions about what the proper sequence of the five books of Moses should be. And therefore, the Talmud simply didn't feel a need to address it. Here's the Talmud, the passage in greater length. Talmud says as follows, and again, on account of constraints of time, we'll read this in English. This is the Sansino translation, so we'll just trust them. Talmud, having listed the books of Nevi'im and the books of Ketuvim in order, in sequence, now says, let's examine this. That is to say, what's the rationale behind it? So the Talmud tells us that actually the first of all of the prophets, so they maintain, was the prophet Hosea. Why do we assume that Hosea was the first prophet? Now, clearly he wasn't before Moses, okay? But he may have been the first of the later prophets. So why would we presume that he was the first of the later prophets? Because the book of Hosea begins with the verse, Techilat Diber Hashem BeHosea, which could be translated as, first of all, God spoke to Hosea. That would seem to imply that Hosea was the first of the later prophets. In fact, the book of Hosea is the first book in the anthology called Treasar. If you open the so-called minor prophets, the first book is the book of Hosea. And it may very well be the first book in that anthology due to the Talmud having designated it as the first. But you know how the Talmud works. Somebody will make a statement and then somebody else will challenge it. So here we have immediately a challenge. What do you mean that God spoke first to Hosea? Didn't God speak to many prophets between Moses and Hosea? So Talmud says, yeah, you're right. Rabbi Yochanan, however, has explained, and he explains that what it means is not that Hosea was the first of all of the later prophets, but that Hosea was the first of a group of four prophets who prophesied during the same historical period. And who were they? They were the prophets Hosea, Yeshayahu, Amos, and Micha. So, of those four prophets who were reasonably contemporaries, Hosea was the first of them. So, the Talmud asks the obvious question. So, why isn't the book of Hosea listed before the book of Yeshayahu? Shouldn't Hosea then come first? So the answer is that if every one of the so-called 12 minor prophets were to have an independent book of his own, then Hosea would have to come before Yeshayahu in a chronological order. However, the Talmud says, since the prophecy of Hosea is written along with those of Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, and Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi were the last of all the prophets. You remember that their books were written during the Babylonian exile and the Persian period. So since the book of Hosea has to be bound together with the books of these three later prophets, then it says, Chashiv le Bahadaihu, the book of Hosea, was reckoned along with them. But then the Talmud asks a very good question. Why does he have to, as it were, suffer to be born, to be placed together with those other three prophets? Why shouldn't he have an independent book of his own? And for that matter, why shouldn't Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi each have an independent book of his own? So the answer is really one that I anticipated previously. When I explained to you that the term minor prophets should not be understood as minor in significance, but it's minor in size, that's basically what the Talmud says. Talmud says, Aidi dezutar mirkas. Since the several of the books of the Treasar are so small, if each of them were to be an independent scroll, then we simply were afraid that they would get lost. Therefore, it would seem that the reason that they were bound together in an anthology of 12 prophets all together was simply practical. Okay. Now, the Talmud goes on. And it raises the question, another question that I anticipated. As I said, when we look into our printed Tanakh, the order of the so-called, the three larger books of the prophets, Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, and Yechezkel, is a chronological order. While the order in the Talmud, Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel, and Yeshayahu, is clearly not a chronological order. So what rationale dictated the Talmudic order? Continue. Let's again look into this. Isaiah, right, preceded Jeremiah, and Jeremiah preceded Ezekiel. So obviously, if we're going by a strictly chronological order, the Talmud says, why shouldn't Isaiah be placed first? And the answer is because the Talmud did not dictate the order of the books by the chronology of their authors, but by their content. And it explains as follows. Because the book of Kings, Sefer Melachim, ends with a record of destruction, it ends with the destruction of the first temple and the exile of the people of Judah and Jerusalem to Babylonia. And what does the book of Jeremiah do? Jeremiah speaks throughout of destruction. That's what the book of Jeremiah is about. Jeremiah warns the people of the imminent Babylonian invasion and destruction. Jeremiah counsels them on how to comport themselves during their exile. So basically, we see that their organization is a thematic one. We go from the book of Kings, which ends on a note of destruction, to the book of Jeremiah, which is primarily a book that discusses different aspects of the destruction. And Ezekiel commences with destruction because Ezekiel lived in Babylonia and was in Babylonia when the news came about the destruction of the temple. Therefore, the first part of the book of Ezekiel resembles the book of Jeremiah in that it deals with matters of destruction. But then the second half of the book of Ezekiel deals with matters of consolation. He speaks about how the people will return to the land of Israel. You surely are acquainted with Ezekiel's grand vision of the dry bones, which represented the rebirth of the Jewish nation. Okay? Therefore, Ezekiel follows Jeremiah because destruction is linked to destruction. But because the book of Ezekiel ends not on a note of destruction, but on a note of consolation, we therefore follow that with the book of Isaiah, because the Talmud says that Isaiah is kulei nechemta, deals throughout or full with matters of consolation. And therefore says the Talmud, samchinan churbena lechurbena, we place matters of texts that deal with the theme of destruction next to each other, v'nechemta l'nechemta, and books that deal primarily with consolation next to each other. So whereas our Tanakhim seem to be organized along a strictly chronological sequence, the Talmud offers an alternative sequence that is based instead on themes. Moving ahead, the Talmud, having now enumerated the different books of Nevi'im and Ketuvim in what the Talmud considered to be their proper sequence, moves to the consideration of Umi Ketavan, who were the authors of the biblical books. And here we have a list, as you see. Moses and Joshua and Samuel and David, Jeremiah, Hezekiah, the men of the great assembly, and Ezra. Altogether, 8 either individuals or groups of people in 2 cases, who amongst them are responsible for either the authorship, or as we will see when we get into the text a little more closely, if not the author, then at least the editor of the books. Because as you can see, certainly in the case of David, who takes up not the usual one line, but takes up 3 or more lines, David is said to have been the author of the book of Psalms, al yedei asara zekenim, having included in it or having been joined in the authorship of the book of Psalms by no fewer than 10 other people. So where the Talmud says that somebody wrote a biblical book, it could be the original author, but as I said, it could also be someone who was either the editor or redactor of that book. Now, while the Talmud, as we noticed previously, listed only the order of the books of Nevi'im and Ketuvim and had nothing to say about the order of the 5 books of Moses, because as I surmised, no one had ever raised any question about it. When the Talmud comes to discuss the authorship of the books of the Bible, it starts with the Torah. But it's curious. It doesn't say Moshe katav et ha-Torah. It doesn't say Moses wrote the Torah. What it says instead is that Moses wrote Sifro, his book. Now, if you were to tell me, what's the big deal? Moses' book is the Torah. How do I know that Moses' book is the Torah? Because wherever the Torah is referred to by name elsewhere in the Bible, it is almost invariably called Sefer Torat Moshe, the book of Moses' Torah. So if you tell me that Moses wrote his book, then I know that it's talking about the Torah because there's no other book for which Moses was responsible. But then you didn't read the rest of the sentence, because it says that in addition to writing his book, Moses also wrote something called Parashat Bilaam, the portion of Bilaam, Ve'iyov, and the book of Job. So, Moses didn't write only the Torah, at least according to this Talmudic passage, but that Moses seems to have written something else in addition to the Torah. If we assume, and at least we're entitled to, for reasons that I cannot bring here in detail, but it's consistent with the Talmud's subsequent discussion, the Talmud is willing to credit Moses with the authorship of the book of Job. So where it says Moshe Katav Ve'iyov, it is certainly acceptable and an adequate interpretation to say that it's a reference to what we call the book of Job. But the big question, of course, is what did the Talmud mean when it attributed to Moses something called the portion of Bilaam? We'll get to that in a subsequent lesson. Right now, I just want to hold at this point and move along on the question of Moses writing his own book. We'll take up this question again later on in this, I'll call it a term of study, when we come into the modern period and we talk about the challenges to the Jewish tradition of the Bible that emanate either from what is called biblical criticism or in some cases from biblical archaeology. Right now, I want to talk about the authorship of the Torah entirely from within the Jewish tradition. And what you see on the screen in front of you is the eighth of Maimonides' 13 articles of faith. It reads, Ani ma'amin, I believe, be'emunah shelema, with a perfect faith, shekol ha-Torah ha-mitzuyah ha-ta v'yadenu, that the entire Torah, as we possess it today, he, that Torah, ha-netunah le-Moshe Rabbeinu alav ha-shalom, is the Torah that was given to our teacher Moses. This would seem to imply that Maimonides considered it to be an article of faith that Moses wrote the entire Torah. And therefore, ostensibly, anybody who would argue for the post-Mosaic authorship of any portion of the Torah would be contradicting this Maimonidean article of faith. But that can't be the case, because here is the continuation of the Talmudic passage that we've been discussing since we started. Notice, it says, Amar Mar, a teacher taught, Yehoshua Katav Sifro, Joshua wrote his book, that I assume would be the book that we call the book of Joshua, U, and Shmona Pesukim Sheba Torah. So according to this Talmudic authority, Joshua, in addition to writing the book of Joshua, was also responsible for writing 8 verses in the Torah. Which 8 verses in the Torah? The Talmud says that this statement is in agreement with the authority who says that 8 verses in the Torah written by Joshua, as has been taught. It says, Vayamot Sham Moshe Eved Hashem. There on Mount Nebo, Moses, the servant of the Lord, died. Okay? That is 8 psukim from the end of the Torah. And the person who says that Joshua wrote these last eight psukim offered a rationale. His rationale was, if Shar Moshe met v'katav v'yamot Shar Moshe, is it conceivable that Moses, having died, because it says Moses died, could Moses have then written about his own death? Of course not. Ella, rather, Adkan, up to the eighth from the last verse, Katav Moshe, Moses was the author. Mikan va'elach, but the remaining eight verses in the Torah, Katav Yehoshua. So, let's go back for a moment to the previous text. It says here that I should believe with a perfect faith that the entire Torah, including the last eight verses, is the identical Torah that was given to Moses. Now, is it conceivable that Maimonides would have found this Talmudic authority to be in violation of an article of faith? No, it's not conceivable. Therefore, it would stand to reason, logically, that that's not what Maimonides intended. That when Maimonides said that we are required to believe in a perfect faith in something about the Torah and something about Moses' authorship of it, Maimonides was not requiring us to believe that every word in the Torah necessarily was written by Moses. How can I state that with such conviction? Because I have what Maimonides actually wrote. If you don't know, and didn't know until this evening, that the so-called Yod Gimel Midot, the 13 articles of faith of Maimonides that are printed in just about every Siddur, if you didn't know until this evening, then I have to tell you, Maimonides did not write those 13 articles of faith. He did not formulate them. Maimonides did have 13 articles of faith. He wrote about them at considerable length as part of his commentary on the Mishnah. In his commentary on the Mishnah, in the end of the Tractate of Sanhedrin, the Mishnah that says, Kol Yisrael Yesh Lam Chelek L'Olam Haba, that the default position is that every Jew has a share in the world to come. However, there are Jews who can forfeit their share in the world to come. Maimonides formulated 13 articles of faith, basically to say that anyone who disagrees with any of these 13 articles of faith has forfeited his share in the world to come. And since, as I said, it's inconceivable that Maimonides would have thought that a Talmudic sage had forfeited his share in the world to come, it's obvious that Maimonides did not consider it an article of faith to believe that every word in the Torah was written by Moses. What did Maimonides require? You can see the highlighted passage here. What Maimonides required Jews to believe in with a perfect faith is that every word in the Torah is of divine origin. Shehi kulam mipi hagivura. That everything in the Torah was written at the dictation of God. But for words in the Torah to be written at the dictation of God, they do not necessarily have to have been written by Moses, because Moses surely was not the only person, or even for that matter, the only prophet to whom God appeared and with whom God spoke and to whom God gave dictation. Arguably then, anything in the Torah that wasn't written by Moses, but was written by another prophet, who wrote it not on his own recognizance, but because God instructed him to write it, then that would be acceptable to Maimonides, because even though it wouldn't be Mosaic authorship, it would still be consistent with the principle that the entire Torah is of divine origin. To use two more conventional terms to describe this dichotomy, Maimonides would require us to believe in Torah min hashamayim, but would not necessarily require us to believe in Torah misinai. We must believe that the Torah is all of divine origin, but not necessarily that every word of the Torah was dictated to Moses at Sinai. And indeed, we will look at this again in subsequent times in greater detail. That opinion was held by one of the principal medieval commentators on the Torah, Rabbi Abraham Ibn Ezra, who lived in Spain during the 11th and early part of the 12th century. Ibn Ezra wrote in the beginning, as you see here, the beginning of his commentary on the book of Deuteronomy, in his typical, somewhat cryptic style, he wrote, "If you understand Sod Hashneim Asar, the secret of the 12, Takir Ha'emet, then you will recognize the truth." What is the Sod Hashneim Asar? What is the secret of the 12? That's contained in his commentary at the beginning of Deuteronomy chapter 34, the last chapter in Deuteronomy. Now, we already saw in the Talmud that there was a Talmudic master who was prepared to attribute the last 8 verses in the Torah to Joshua. Chapter 34 is the last chapter in the book of Deuteronomy. Anybody want to guess how many verses there are in chapter 34 altogether? We know there are at least 8. Those are the last 8 verses that were attributed to Joshua. How many verses are there in chapter 34 altogether? 12. So Ibn Ezra here, at the beginning of his commentary to the last chapter of the book of Deuteronomy, says, "Lefi da'ati, in my opinion, mizeh ha'pasuk katav Yehoshua," that Joshua didn't write only the last 8 verses in the Torah, but according to Ibn Ezra, Joshua wrote the last 12 verses in the Torah. Now, if you ask me, the Talmud was prepared to argue that Joshua wrote 8 verses. What gives Ibn Ezra the right to extend that further and to argue that Joshua wrote not only 8, but 12 verses? And to tell you the truth, this isn't all. Ibn Ezra believes that there are other verses in the Torah that if they were not written by Joshua, they certainly weren't written by Moses. How does Ibn Ezra get to dare, as it were, to do this? I suspect that it's because the Talmud presented this to us not as a matter of dogma and doctrine, but the Talmud presented this to us as a matter of reason and logic. If the Talmud had just simply declared, Moses wrote the Torah, Joshua wrote 8 verses in the Torah, and moved on from there, then it would have been a matter of dogma. That is to say, I accept it because the Talmud is authoritative. What motivated the Talmud to say that? I don't know. You know, of course, what Tevye would say, tradition. Okay? But we saw the Talmud didn't do that. The Talmud didn't argue for Joshua's authorship based on a dogmatic tradition. The Talmud argued for Joshua's authorship based on logic. Could Moses have described the circumstances of his own death and burial? Of course not. So it seems to me that what Ibn Ezra did is say, you know, logic isn't something that you can simply limit. If something is logical, then it has to be followed to what we call its logical conclusion. Therefore, said Ibn Ezra, if I can find grounds to challenge Moses' authorship of other biblical verses, then the Talmud has established the precedent that that is permissible. And indeed, we'll close out this evening's session, and then I'll look at the chat, with a citation from a later biblical commentator, who actually was not a commentator on the Bible directly, but who wrote a super commentary to the commentary of Ibn Ezra. And where Ibn Ezra, in his commentary in Genesis, mentions for the first time the possibility that there is a verse that was not written by Moses, Yosef Tuv Elem, in his commentary on Ibn Ezra, called Sofnat Pa'aneach, says, after all, Mali Shektavo Moshe, what does it matter whether the verse was written by Moses? Mali Shektavo Navi Acher, or whether the same verse was written by another legitimate prophet? Ho'il, if in both cases, Divrei Kulam Emet, both of them are speaking the truth, V'heim B'Nevu'ah, and they were both prophets. Therefore, it seems at least that it has been part and parcel of the Jewish tradition, going back at least until Ibn Ezra, if not back to Maimonides, and back further to Ibn Ezra, if not back to the Talmud itself, that it is not a necessary article of faith to believe that Moses wrote every word in the Torah, but to believe that every word in the Torah, whether it was written by Moses or written by a later prophet, was written only at the behest and at the dictate of God. Whoa, lots of comments here. I will try to do my best. Oh, a lot of them are just... Okay, Moses died during Deuteronomy. Who wrote the end of the book? Okay, I'm sure you got the answer by now. Okay. What happened to the book of Jonah? Book of Jonah is part of the Treas, or part of the 12. Okay. Oh, see, somebody answered for me. Okay. How many of the 24 parts of 24 have rough equivalents in other cultures? I don't know what that means to have an equivalent in another culture. Oh, I mean, like the Code of Hammurabi or flood story. Oh, that's an intriguing question. I don't have a number at my fingertips. Obviously, parts of the book of Genesis are talk about flood and creation, and just about every culture and civilization on earth has a record of creation, and many of them also have records of floods. I couldn't give you a number, but that's certainly widespread. And if we take portions of the book of Exodus or Deuteronomy that are legislative, then obviously, again, most major civilizations, whether they were Mesopotamian or Egyptian, certainly had codes of law. Isn't traditional chronological order of Solomon's books? We'll get to that. We'll get to the Megillot in detail in a subsequent lesson. My Tanakh has Lamentations as, no. Kohelet is Ecclesiastes, not Lamentations. Your Tanakh, if it has Kohelet, Kohelet is the book that in English is called Ecclesiastes. The word Kohelet itself comes from the Hebrew root that means to gather together. And the word Ecclesiastes, like ecclesiastical, means when you gather people together. Okay. Lamentations is, you know, when you mourn something, and that's what the word keynote means. Keynote means mourning or lamentations. Okay. All right. When books were independent scrolls, what does it mean by ordering or sequence? Ah, that's a very good question. It would seem that it has certain practical religious significance, meaning that the scrolls had to be stored. Arguably, the scrolls were stored one on top of the other. So it would seem to be that when it said, for example, that the order is Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Isaiah, then it meant that if you were stacking them up, that's the order in which you should stack them. Okay. I'm sorry if it's jarring to keep hearing Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel, but just for the sake of people who may not be fluent in Hebrew or recognize the names in Hebrew, I will continue to refer to them in English as well. Okay. I don't know what Maimonides was careful not to offend his Islamic hosts. I don't know what that is relationship to. Maimonides, Rambam also needed to defend Torah against Muslim claims that the Jews had falsified the text of divine revelation. Okay, that is a completely different facet of Maimonides. It's correct, but it's not particularly germane to our discussion. Okay, I don't know who realized. Moses probably realized that he would not be entering the promised land, but he still, that may have given him the impetus to finish the Torah before he knew that he would die, but it certainly doesn't, still does not satisfactorily explain how he could have written about the circumstances of his own death and burial. And there we go. So I thank you also very much. I hit it on the button. It's 9 o'clock. Thank you also very much for joining. And I look forward to seeing you again next week at the same time, minus an hour.
Why minus an hour? Oh, minus, yes, yes.
Thank you. I won't be able to say that after a couple of weeks. Then
We change the clock. We don't change the clock this week. I know what you mean. Yeah, 8 o'clock. Right.
Then I'll be able to say at the same time.
Yes, yes, but okay. All right, thank you. We look forward to next week. Tomorrow, of course, as I mentioned, Shuli Mishkan's regular class will not be taking place because we sure a mazel tov on the marriage of her son. But 8:30 tomorrow evening, Eastern time, Rabbi David Blackman, live from Sydney, Australia. So he'll be on Friday. We'll be at Friday morning, and that's tomorrow night. And then Friday morning, my shiur on the Siddur at 9:30 a.m., Menachem Liebtag Sunday at 11:15, our regular schedule next week. Now we've got all our series all going, and we look forward to learning with you. And like I say, please bring a friend. Always interested in your comments and suggestions, and always want to hear from people. But our best form of advertising, as I always say, is word of mouth. So please invite a friend, and we look forward to learning with you. And thank you very much. And okay, have a wonderful day and evening, and Laila Tov, and we look forward to learning with you in the near future. Be well, everybody.
Thank you very much. Have a good night. Thank you.
Good night. Good night.
Wonderful. Good night.